So hello and welcome to another episode of Open Studio. I'm your host, Martina Flor, and today I'm thrilled to have Annie Atkins joining me. As a graphic designer for the film industry, Annie creates graphic props and set pieces for movie productions all over the world. She worked across multiple films, including Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel, The French Dispatch, and Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies. In 2020, she published a book called Fake Love Letters, Forged Telegrams, and Prisonscape Maps, designing graphic props for filmmaking, giving readers a peek into the intricate creative process behind her designs. Annie lives in Dublin, Ireland, with her family, and she's here with us today, and I'm super thrilled to have you. Hi, Annie, how are you doing today? Thank you for coming on the show.
Hi, Martina. I'm good, yeah. Thank you for having me on the show. It's nice to talk to you.
Annie, I'm super happy to have you on the podcast today because you work in an industry that is very exciting, mysterious, unusual, and we want to know all about it. But before we dive into that, I'm curious to know about how did it all start? How did you first get involved with graphic design at all? What were your first steps?
I mean, my very first steps with graphic design was my dad was a graphic designer. So that was pretty easy for me. I just, when I was a little kid, that's what I wanted to do. There was no big ambition there, really. And so I went to college. I studied visual communication design. I graduated. I went to work in an ad agency as a graphic designer. I always thought I was pretty good at graphic design. I always thought I was pretty good at art and everything design related. You know, I had a lot of confidence. I'd done all my studies and everything. And then when I was working in advertising, I suppose I started to feel like I really wasn't good at it at all.
Why did you feel this way?
Do you know what? I think I actually wasn't a very good graphic designer when I was younger, when I was first starting out. And I think a lot of people aren't. You know, it takes a long time. It takes practice, you know? But I think that kind of shook my confidence a little bit. And I just decided it wasn't for me after all. I didn't have very good sensibilities with colour, with layout design, with typography. I didn't have a clue what a good font was or a good typeface was. I suppose I was just very green. I mean, I was young. I was a graduate. I was 20, 21, 22. Oh, okay. I don't feel I had really got a great graphic design education in college. My college had been going through a bit of a tricky time when I was studying there. I wasn't really into it in college. I got by. And then that showed, I think, when I went into the ad agency and started having to do quite, you know, traditional graphic layout design and things. It wasn't great. So then I decided to leave it all behind me. And I decided to leave advertising, leave design, and go back to school and study a completely different subject.
So you mentioned that your dad was a graphic designer. Do you feel that there was a path drawn to you when you grew up? Do you feel that your dad showed you the way in a way into graphic design, or this was something that as it seemed natural to you and you had all this experience growing up, it felt like a natural path to you to go down the path of graphic design?
Yeah, it was a completely natural path. Like I could say I was a nepo baby. Because, you know, if you have a parent or any kind of like really strong role model who does a certain job, it's very, very easy for you to follow in their footsteps, you know. I mean, I know there's a lot of talk about this at the moment with like celebrities and actors and things. And I have to say, yeah, it is really easy. And I see a lot of people who come to my workshops who have never had that role model at all. You know, they've never had anybody in their family who's a designer. They've never had anybody who's an artist or who's done anything kind of visual for a living. And they don't have that same confidence. You know, they feel much more insecure about it. And very much like, is this really something I could do? And I find that with those students, they don't need very much. They just need somebody to say, yeah, you can, you know, and that's great, you know, when you find a teacher who does that for you. But yeah, definitely, I think if you have a parent who works in the field, then yeah, it's a very easy path to go down.
Yeah, and I think also, just to add to that, I think sometimes you need to see someone doing that thing to understand, okay, that's something I could possibly do, right? I remember, like, the first time I met an actual lettering artist, I thought, like, oh, you can actually work doing this. And for me, there was a tipping point in terms of saying, like, okay, if he's doing it, I can do it too. If he's calling himself lettering artist, I can do it as well. So you mentioned before that that you left the ad world because you didn't feel good enough at it. So how did you then steer into the film industry and creating props for films, which is what you mainly do nowadays?
Yeah, so it's been quite a funny, it's all kind of come full circle really, because now I do work in branding sometimes again, but I have a very different approach to it now because I've gone through the whole film path. So I decided I was going to leave my role in the advertising agency. And at the time I'd been writing a blog. Now this is way back, this is back in 2007 or something, when blogging was a thing, just before social media. And my boss at the ad agency, Gary, he was the creative director, really great guy. He had been reading my blog and he said, you know, I'm kind of not surprised that you want to leave, and maybe you do need to just go off and do something that's a little bit more emotional for a while. Mm. And I said, you know, I've been thinking about going back to college and studying filmmaking. And he said, I think it's a great idea. Because, you know, working at the ad agency, I was doing a lot of kind of like template based work. And I think I just needed to do something that was maybe a little bit more, I don't know what the word is, really dramatic, maybe.
Yeah.
Without wanting to sound like an asshole. Yeah, I wanted some drama. So I decided to go to film school, but I didn't go to film school with the idea that I would be a designer for film. Mm. I went to film school with the idea that I would be, I don't know, like a director, a screenwriter, a camera operator, you know, any of these jobs that are just very obvious film roles, you know,
yeah,
the film roles that we've heard about. And then, of course, when I started studying filmmaking, because the master's degree I was enrolled on was like very broad, we did a little bit of everything. That's when I discovered design for film. And then it all clicked because, you know, it wasn't that I was a bad designer. I was just in the wrong role and I was just young and inexperienced and I just hadn't really found my path or a style or, you know, a way to make design work for things other than, I don't know, Coca-Cola magazine adverts.
So for those that are listening right now and don't know exactly what creating props for films is, can you shortly explain what is it about and what the work involves?
Yeah, so my role in film is very, very specific prop design role. It's graphic prop making and graphic set design. So in film, we just call it graphic design. But it's making all the pieces that the actors actually handle in sets that are pieces of graphic material. So newspapers, telegrams, bus tickets, cigarette packets, anything that's made out of paper, anything that has lettering on it, anything that has some kind of photo or illustration on it, anything that has a pattern on it. And this would be set pieces as well. So if it was, say, a big piece of signage or billboards in the background or shopfront signs, posters on the wall, dressing for a set, like notice boards in somebody's office would have to be covered with little bits of paper with appropriate things written on them. Yeah, that's it. That's in a nutshell, really. And it's a full-time job. You know, it's I know that when we watch movies, we don't see most of this stuff. Mm. So it's hard to fathom that this could be a full-time job for 2-3 graphic designers for the absolute duration of a TV show or movie. But it absolutely is. Like, it's actually more work than we can handle. Yeah. It's very busy.
So let's imagine that you have recently, like, started a new movie project. Could you, just to understand how your world is as a graphic designer for films, could you guide us through the process? Like, what are the key steps? Where do you start? When do you meet with the people that are involved? When do you have interactions with the director? How does this project evolve?
Yeah, so you're usually hired by the production designer or the art director, who are the people who are designing the entire movie. And you're brought into the art department with a few weeks of prep before the camera starts rolling, basically. And in the art department is where everybody else sits, like the drafts people, the set designers, this whole set decorating team. It's a kind of like another leg of the design. And hopefully you get a desk and a chair, and sometimes you get a desk lamp, and you have to bring all your stuff with you.
Really fancy.
Yeah, you bring your computer, you bring your scanner, you bring your printer, you bring all your whatever tools you use, your pencil case. Usually the first thing you do is you sit down with a script and a highlighter pen, and you go through the script and you mark out anything that sounds like it's going to be a piece of graphic design. Mm-hmm. Because you know then that that's going to be your responsibility to produce it. With directors, it's different. It's different on different movies. Like, you don't, a graphic designer doesn't always work directly for the director. Usually you're working for the art directors, the production designer, the set decorators, the prop master, whoever it is that's kind of in charge of any given piece. Yeah. I've done a lot of work with Wes Anderson in the past, and he's very involved with his art department, so then you would talk directly to a director like that. But you know, I've done other movies where I've never even seen the director.
Yeah. And Annie, I was wondering, because you mentioned that you take the script and you mark all the scenes where you believe that there will be some prop design involved. So you don't necessarily get a proper briefing with a list of the different props that you have to create. You have to be kind of autonomous around what is the work that you need to do.
You make your own list. Yeah, you make your own list. I mean, that's how you start, is you make your own list. And that list could be like 20 pages long. Uh-huh. And this would be all the things that you identify from the script. So some things are really obvious. Like, if a character is sitting in a restaurant and they're ordering a meal, you need to make a menu for the restaurant. You know, if the character's sitting in a restaurant and they're not ordering a meal, you still have to think like, yeah, but this restaurant needs menus on the tables, even in the background, you know? Sure. So you're always thinking around the whole set. It takes practice. You get better at that as you go along. You know, the more, you know, every time you do an office scene, you think about, you understand more what the requirements are for a scene like that. And then there are other directions that you're given. Like, there's often concept art. So sometimes you'll see a scene that's been drawn by a concept artist and you'll say, oh, okay, there's like posters in the background of this scene, so I'm going to need to make those. Mm. And then other times you'll get verbal direction from the set decorator, the art director, the production designers. And then sometimes you'll also get technical drawings of street scenes, for example. And then you can see, okay, this street scene is going to have 5 shop fronts in it, so I'm going to need to make 5 shops. And I'm going to have to make, you know, whatever else there is needed to dress that scene. So the information about what you need to do can come from many, many different sources. And it usually is flying at you quite fast and landing on your desk quite fast, and you have to work hard to keep up with that.
Yeah, in fact, I have friends in the film industry, and they're always on the run, right, and working crazy hours. Is this the same way for you as a prop designer?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think time's always against you on a film job. Any film or TV show I've ever worked on, time has been against me. I don't think I've ever felt relaxed on any show, except maybe if you're doing like the second season of a TV show that you've already done the first season for. It's a little bit more relaxed because you have stuff in your back pocket that you can pull out, but generally, like, the pressure is on. I mean, film hours, we film is unionized, so, you know, we're paid from 8 o'clock in the morning until 6:30 p.m. or 7 p.m. depending on the production. And you can often have to stay a little bit later than that. I'm quite vigilant about clocking off when I'm asked to. Like, you know, if we finish at 6:30, I try to finish at 6:30. Because it's a long enough day as it is, and it's an intense day. So, you know, it's not just long hours, but the amount of work you produce in that day. I mean, you might produce like 20 pieces of graphic design in that day. So yeah, I do try to leave work on time.
So, and it seems that a lot of things are done on the go. Like you can prepare things up front, but some things are done in the on the scene. Is that correct?
What, while they're shooting the scene?
Yes. So it seems that a lot of the things are created in the moment. Or is that is something that you plan ahead and you have all the pieces put together and then you bring them to scene?
I mean, I try to have everything ahead of time.
For sure.
Because the last thing you want is to be radioed up from the set saying, you know, we don't have a telegram.
Yes.
It takes time to make these things, and like actors are all there, everyone's in costume and makeup, like the lights are ready, you know. It does happen. It sometimes happens. It happened to me on a Spielberg job. We got radioed up to the arts department from the set. We didn't have a label for a bottle, a bottle of brandy. And somehow I had just missed it. I'd completely missed it in the script. I'd completely missed it. Like nobody had caught it. And it was quite a key scene because Tom Hanks's character, who was like the good guy, was being offered a glass of brandy by the baddie character, right? And the feeling in the scene was supposed to be like, is this brandy poisoned? So, you know, this is kind of what we would call a hero prop. I mean, it has relevance to the story. It wasn't one to miss in the script, I'll say that. And I had to make it very, very quickly. I like made it and designed it, printed it out and stuck it to the bottle in 20 minutes or something. And you have a little bit of time because they're still setting up the scene and, I don't know, the camera crew are doing their job and, you know, whatever they do with the lights down there. I don't know what they do. But the problem is then like legal clearance, and I had to send that prop to clearance to make sure that it was okay to use in the movie. And of course the clearance officer was in Los Angeles and we were shooting in Germany. So it wasn't until the next morning I got the email saying, no, this is not clear to use. You can't use it. It's too close. The design was too close to a real Armenian brandy label.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of sleepless nights over that because we'd already shot it, you know.
And what did you do then? I bet that a lot of our listeners are looking, are Googling for this whiskey bottle.
You know, the thing is, luckily for me, most of what I make is never seen, okay? Because most of the graphic design you put in a movie set is in the blurry background.
Yeah.
It's not in focus. You know, the camera is looking at Tom Hanks's face. It's not looking at a piece of graphic design. And while this can often be a little bit disappointing, in a case like this, it's really relieving because we never actually saw the bottle. I don't know what happened. Maybe his hand was over the label when he poured the brandy, or it was out of focus, or whatever it was. It just wasn't seen. So that was totally fine. But you can you don't know what's going to be seen. So you have to make sure that all the work you make is legally clear to use, is right for the period, is right for the place, is right for the genre and the tone of the script. Because you never really know for sure when you're going to get your close-up.
It's so interesting because you mentioned now, and I was during my research, I also read something about the fact that a big portion of your work, 90%, around 90% of your work remains in the background and should never be noticed. And you said something like you quoted someone saying that if our work or if the prop is noticed, then we are not doing our job right. And I wonder, how do you approach the creation of something like this? Because I feel that as graphic artists, or most graphic artists or graphic designers, they invest a lot of time into creating something that really stands out, that really gets noticed. And your work is rather the opposite. It's kind of like staying in the background. So how do you approach that?
Yeah, sort of well, it's a funny balance because that quote is right. That was Robin Miller, my dear friend Robin Miller. He's a prop master in California. And I think he said that in an interview that he gave to a magazine once. And he's absolutely right that when you start noticing the props, your eye is being drawn from the real drama that's unfolding between the characters, right? It's not always true. I mean, some directors use props and use visuals as part of their storytelling. But for the most part, you shouldn't be analysing the little bits of paper in the background, right?
Yeah.
And one way we can stop this happening is actually to put more detail into our props. Okay, so sometimes when a piece of graphic design has less detail in it, it really stands out. But the more detail we add, and the more period detail, the more genre detail, the more it kind of melts into the background, blends in. And that's where research comes in, really. Like, we spend quite a lot of time researching and making sure we understand our different times and countries around the world and what calligraphy looked like in, you know, Eastern Europe in the in the 1930s as opposed to America in the 1950s, you know. Like, we do spend a lot of time getting these things right so that they disappear.
Yeah. So, and I was wondering about your book, because you released Fake Love Letters, that's a long name, Fake Love Letters, Forged Telegrams, and Prisonscape Maps, Designing Graphic Props for Filmmaking in 2020. And you, I was looking at your website, you also launched a Domestika course, you also host your own workshops, and it seems that there's a drive in you, and correct me if I'm wrong, to share all that you know with other people. And I mean, you know, creating a book is a lot of work, and it's really no small project. And I wonder if you can share what your vision was by creating all these different elements, the book, the workshops, and what is the motivation behind sharing all this information with others?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose my original motivation was on one of my very first jobs, on a TV show that I worked on. I was being sent interns from the from production, and the interns were helping me do things like cut and stick and fold lots of cigarette packets, for example. You know, a lot of these jobs are very kind of time consuming and laborious. And what I kept finding was the interns that I was getting from the production office had no interest in graphic design whatsoever. Like, they were in film because they want to be the director, you know. That they were like the producer's nephew, for example, you know. And I kept thinking to myself, do you know, I know so many graphic designers who would give their right arm to sit here all day and make fake cigarette boxes, you know. And I felt that a lot of people, like, coming into the graphics department were not coming from graphic design backgrounds. They were just kind of coming in because it was a place where we need lots of extra help. And really their aim was to eventually, you know, direct. And I just began to think, okay, we need actual graphic designers coming into the industry who are really excited about all these boring graphic things that we make. Because, you know, in our world, like, and in your world as designers and artists, like, these things are fascinating to us. So that's when I decided, do you know what, I'm going to start running workshops from my studio. And I did those for a few years before I started the Domestika course. And I think my workshops, my private workshops here in Dublin and the Domestika course, like, content wise, they're quite similar, you know, and it's a lot of stuff from my book as well. But the Domestika course is just, like, much more easily accessible, you know, because they're very affordable. I mean, are you familiar with Domestika?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, like, you can learn anything you want there, you know, like, for, like, €7, you know. So that was good, getting that done last year.
Yeah, and what is it, that experience for students that come to your studio to work alongside with you and learn from you? How does this look like?
So that's the private workshops that I run here in Dublin. That's a 2-day workshop. We usually do it on a weekend, Saturday and Sunday, full days. It's pretty intense. Like, there's a lot to get through in 2 days. So day one is, like, in the morning, I'm talking about the industry and introducing them to the subject and showing them some little design things that I do to make things look period and showing them my tricks in how to make things look authentic. And then in the afternoon, we do some little prop making exercises, just like very simple things like a little bit of binding, stitching, calligraphy, not really calligraphy. It's more about cheating at calligraphy to create period handwriting. It's more handwriting. In film, we call it calligraphy, but it's actually just handwriting.
Yeah.
Because it's for characters in the movie. And that's day one. And then day two is over to them, and they have to present an idea for a collection of graphic props that they want to make for a character. 5 pieces. And they show reference material to show the kind of styles that they're looking at that they might kind of copy. And then I workshop those pieces with them so that they can go away knowing exactly how they would make those pieces.
Yeah.
So if somebody wants to make a newspaper, for example, like we make loads of newspapers for movies. There's always a newspaper in a movie telling the audience what's going on in the world, you know. I will show them how to achieve like an old mid-century printed look and how to make something look like, I think the problem is when people are starting out is everything they make looks very digital and very modern and very clean and crisp and vector based. And my whole thing is, you know, genre work, period work. So I can show them how to stop things looking like that. Sometimes we use real techniques and sometimes we do use digital tricks.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this because it seems that, you know, by flipping through the book, it seems that you do a lot of things by hand. You use a real typewriter. You dye your papers with coffee or tea. So it seems that you know, there's a strong imprint of analog techniques in your work. And I wonder nowadays, and especially in the film industry, where everything moves so fast and you have such tight deadlines, as you mentioned, how do you strike that balance between analog, digital, and also, you know, sticking to the deadlines of a movie project, for instance?
Yeah, when I first started, my first job was on a show called The Tudors, which was about Henry VIII. So,
yeah.
You know, it's in the, 14th century, 15th century. And because I was so new to it all and everything I'd done before had been digital, you know, I came in thinking that I could just speed things up for everybody and make everything digitally now, you know. And that was a real steep learning curve to me to understand that, no, you can't just use a handwriting font in place of calligraphy, you know.
Yeah.
That we do have to do things the right way or the analog way. I mean, sometimes we use digital tricks and what I've learned to do is cut back and forth all day long between my drawing board and my computer and my scanner. So I'm constantly using analog tools like rubber stamps or real pen and ink. And then I'm scanning it in and I'm bringing it into Photoshop and I'm doing what I need to do there. And what I try to tell my students is, like, don't assume that the analog way is always the slowest way.
Yeah.
Okay, because it's often more effective, but it can also be quicker or as quick as doing things digitally as well. I mean, I've got one example, okay, and I use this example again and again. Fingerprints. If you're making a fingerprint card for the CIA or the FBI, how are you going to create fingerprints?
Yeah.
Well, you're not going to do it in Adobe software. You're going to just get a ink pad and put your fingers in it and print them onto a page and it takes 2 seconds literally, you know. I think that's a learning curve to get your head around the fact, if you are somebody who's worked digitally all your life, to get your head around the fact that once you get into the swing of it, you will actually be pretty quick at this stuff.
That's so interesting, the concept of, like, not necessarily because it's digital it's gonna go faster. So, and also how, you know, how much analog techniques and digital techniques can still have a dialogue, right? And benefit from one another. Annie, you have found a niche in the film industry or creating graphic design for film. And I want to ask you, because this is a big question among graphic artists, graphic designers, should I niche down? Should I find my niche? And I want to ask you, how do you think that finding a niche contributed to your success as a graphic designer, and that if you believe that, you know, identifying in a specific niche can be beneficial for those listening, for new designers or graphic artists that are coming new into the industry.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it is niche. I mean, I've benefited from it in a couple of different ways, okay? So first of all, I mean, I was very lucky that I had a little spotlight shone on my work. So, you know, I was able to do things like publish a book about it. Mm-hmm. And that's been a whole different journey. But in terms of the craft itself, I think the way that it's benefited me mostly is that it's a whole new approach to design for me. So back in my advertising agency days, one of the reasons I was not a good designer is because I started every piece of design, like, you know, original design, like my own creative design, with a blank page.
Yeah.
And we don't do that in film. You know, in filmmaking, where we really succeed is where we are open to absorbing the design from the world around us and imitating it often. Mm. Because if we want our pieces to feel authentic, then we need to start studying pieces from the real world, mm. whatever they are, whether it's a shopfront sign or an old love letter or whatever. You know, a lot of the art of film is actually forgery. Yeah. We're actually copying, you know. And people who work in film, we don't have a hang up about originality the same way people out there in kind of more contemporary design surroundings do, I think. Yeah. I find that a lot of the young people or the graduates who come to my workshops, I find that one of the hurdles I have to get them over is to understand that it's okay to copy, actually. Mm. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, imitating the work of your contemporaries. I'm not talking about going onto, you know, Dribbble or Instagram or wherever and like copying someone else. What I'm talking about is, for example, you know, studying an old map and letting that inform your line style.
Yeah.
Or studying a piece of architecture and letting that inform your costume design. Or, you know, really, really looking at type and understanding how it works the way it does. And I find that once people get over that and they start being more open to imitating, then it's kind of downhill. Like then we can really, really get going. And for me, that's been imperative, not just in film work where you have to work like that to make things feel real, but also now in the branding work that I do outside of my film work. Because I don't do that thing where I open a brand new illustrated document and stare at that awful white page.
Yeah.
You know, I always start with something real. And a big joy in the work for me is in the research and finding these weird and wonderful things that have been made over the centuries and from all the different people from all different walks of life who have made this world that we live in. And what I find is, you never really produce something that's exactly the same because you always have to develop it. Always. Like whether you're developing it to meet the needs of the script or the genre that you're working on or the client that you're working for or the product or whatever it is. Like you will have to adapt and you'll start pushing yourself further. And when you get your final piece, it will be very far removed from the original source material that inspired you, right? So you just have to be unafraid to go that way. So sorry, your original question was about niche. If I had to say niche at all, I would say it's this. It's this core way of working. And it does mean that a lot of my work has a nostalgic look to it. I mean, it's supposed to. That's the world that I work in. But I can't imagine working any other way now. And it's opened up so many doors for me. So I would say, yeah, don't be afraid of being niche at all.
Yeah, sorry, when you say that it has opened so many doors for you, so when you started in the film industry, just to give those that are listening an insight on how do you make your way into a certain industry, you found a niche, and how do you then continue having jobs in that industry, right? So you had your first gig with one movie, and then it just goes from there through word of mouth. Or how did you work your way into getting more jobs and continuing having jobs into the industry?
Yeah, I mean, my first job came up because I went to film school, and while I was studying on that degree, the production designer from the set of The Tudors, Tom Conroy, he came into the school to do a module on design with us. And my course leader, I remember him saying to me, oh, you know, Tom's, you know, he designs some big shows. You need to get your portfolio under his nose because, you know, you come from a graphic design background. Yeah. So show him what you can do. So I said, okay, great. And I showed him my portfolio and he said, you should come for an interview on our third season once you graduate. And I did. And that was my first job. And then I've been working pretty much ever since then with a few gaps. You know, there's always gaps in film when you're not working. But yeah, I've pretty much gone from one job to the next. So when people ask me, you know, do you think studying film is important? I mean, I have to say it was important for me because that's how I got in. But I don't actually think it's the most important thing you can study. Like, if you want to work in film, I don't know that studying film is imperative. I think you need to get into film, I think you need a trade, you need a craft. And you need to study that craft. So if it's graphic design, study graphic design. Like, completely know your onions about graphic design. You know, film needs people from all trades. You know, we have everybody working on a film set. We have electricians, we have painters, we have plasterers, we have scenic artists, we have set designers, makeup artists. So you need a craft and you need to hone your craft. Mm. And that's the best way in, I think.
Yeah, and it's funny because I was about to ask you, well, if I would be a newcomer aspiring graphic designer to enter the film industry, you know, what would be the process? What would be the, you know, the steps that I should follow? And you mentioned a couple of things just now. One of them is that, you know, it seems that for you, putting your foot in the door by studying or actually studying film or movie making help you put your foot in the door into that world or that industry, and that made it easier for you to then apply as a graphic designer into a film production. You mentioned also that you had a portfolio. Which other things or which other elements would you recommend someone to put together in order to land a job in graphic design for films?
So I think probably your first job in a film studio is going to be as an intern or a trainee in the art department.
Yeah.
Assisting the graphic designer. And to do that, I think you need a portfolio that can show that you have traditional graphic design skills, but also I think you need to start showing graphic prop design. Mm-hmm. And this is something you can do in your own time. And it's what I teach my workshop students to do. You know, I say, go off, think of a character from fiction, from a book that you loved as a kid, or from a theatre play or something. Try not to choose movie characters, someone whose props have already been made, and design a small collection of props around that character. So 5 pieces, you know, that say something about that character and can show off new skills, and that will get you to start actually making things with your hands. You know, things that you have to cut out and stick together and fold and dress with other things. I always talk about dressing props, you know, that we have to, if you make a cigarette packet, then put real cigarettes in it, you know. If you make a matchbox, put real matchboxes in it. Playing cards, so on and so forth. You can really start having fun with tactile objects in ways that we don't always when we're working in commercial graphic design. And I always say, you know, try and choose a period or a genre that takes you out of your contemporary world, okay? So something from the past or the future, if you're being really ambitious. The future is difficult because, you know, limited source material. or, you know, choose a fantasy genre, or, you know, children's fantasy or animation or something, so that you can start developing styles or studying styles that are very different to your contemporary graphic design portfolio. And then when you do get an interview for a job, bring these things with you. You know, we don't want to just see things on screen. We want to actually hold these pieces and pick them up, because that's what the actors are going to have to do in a shoot.
That's so useful. And I bet that our listeners are taking notes right now, as I am. So Annie, to wrap up our show, we normally play a little game, which is called a finish the sentence. Do you know it?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so I basically start the sentence and you complete it. So I'm proud of myself because?
I'm proud of myself because I've tried doing things that I wasn't very good at and made them work eventually.
I'm terrible at?
Oh, I'm terrible at vector work and Bezier curves. One day I'm going to quit film completely and retrain as a sign painter.
We're going to be looking after that. We're going to keep you accountable, Annie. I'm always chosen first when it comes to...
I'm always chosen first when it comes to old tea-stained maps.
I could never get bored of...
I could never get bored of my dipping pen and ink.
Thank you so much, Annie. Where can people find you?
My website, annieatkins.com. And Instagram is probably my favorite social media platform, Annie Atkins.
Wonderful. We're going to add all of this to our show notes so that listeners can find you. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Annie, again.
Thank you, Martina. Thanks for the great chat. It was lovely talking to you.
Thanks so much, everybody, for tuning in. And see you on the next episode of Open Studio. Bye-bye. So this is it. I hope you loved this episode. You can find me, the host of the show, on social networks at Martina Flor on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you have a question or comments, go to martinaflor.com/podcast, where you can see previous episodes, find show notes, and send voice memos with your comments and questions. You can also watch these episodes on YouTube. Just go to martinaflor.com/YouTube to find them. You can, of course, listen to all our episodes on your favorite podcast platform. If you loved this episode, subscribe to this podcast. And if you leave us a review, it will help others find us. Thank you all for listening, and see you in the next episode of Martina Flor's Open Studio. Bye-bye.